chromosomes. Little strands of nucleic acids and proteins are the fundamental genetic instructions that tell us who we are at birth. Most people are born with 46 chromosomes, but each year in the United States, about 6,000 people are born with an extra chromosome, making them a person with Down syndrome. If you've ever encountered someone with Down syndrome, you know that they are some of the kindest, most joyful people you will ever meet. They truly have something extra. My name is Lisa Nichols, and I have spent the last 24 years as both the CEO of Technology Partners and as the mother to Allie. Allie has something extra in every sense of the word. I have been blessed to be by her side as she impacts everyone she meets. Through these two important roles as CEO and mother to Allie, I have witnessed countless life lessons that have fundamentally changed the way I look at the world. While you may not have an extra chromosome, every leader has something extra that defines who you are. Join me as I explore the something extra in leaders from all walks of life and discover how that difference in each of them has made a difference in their companies, their families, their communities, and in themselves. If you like this episode today, please go to Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen and leave us a 5-star rating. I'm delighted to have Sean Copeland on the show today. Sean is an author, podcast host, and the chairman and CEO at Regent Bank. Well, welcome to the Something Extra podcast, Sean Copeland. I'm so delighted that we were able to make this happen.
Thank you, Lisa. It's an honor.
Well, we're going to have a lot of fun because every time that we have talked, we have fun. So I expect the same to be true for today. So you and I were introduced. I always love to tell our listeners how these connections happen, Sean. And you and I were introduced last fall through our mutual friend, Matt Granados.
Love Matt Granados and love you guys. And Matt is a connector. I mean, he has introduced me, and I know he's done the same for you, to some of the neatest people. That is such an amazing gifting, and I'm so happy that I got to meet you all.
Yeah, well, I'm happy too. Greg and I just attended their Heels for Hope gala a few weeks ago. And this was to raise money for children with rare diseases. Really gripped our heart, Sean. I think they raised a lot of money. So he and Maria are doing really wonderful things. But I want to talk to you about a lot of different things. Your life as a banker, a bank owner, Secretary of Commerce and Workforce Development in the Governor's Cabinet. You're a baseball coach, and we'll talk a little bit about that. An author, board member, speaker. Oh my goodness, I told you I need to know what kind of energy pill you're taking every day. You've just got amazing energy, my friend.
Well, thank you. I always have been that way. My dad just popped into my office a while ago. I just came back from Oklahoma City and had a little bit of time before our podcast. And he just showed up. He's a farmer and had been up to the stockyards and stopped back by, and we had lunch together. And he said, I don't know where you got this, but apparently I have always been this way. He said, it's just the way I was born. With a fast motor, have always had a lot going on. It's just kind of how I am wired, but really more so whenever you can do things that are in your purpose, you know, and you feel passionate about those things. And that's where I get to live right now. And it's truly a blessing.
I know you do
that too, Lisa. not very many people get to live the lives that we get to live. I just feel very, very fortunate.
I agree. Yeah. And we're going to talk a little bit about purpose and, you know, that purpose fuels your passion, right, Sean? That sort of thing. But take me back. I want to go back to the very beginning. No, I'm teasing. I do want to go back though to when you grew up, and you grew up in Beggs, Oklahoma, about 30 miles or so from Tulsa, I think.
Just around.
A huge town, really big town, 1,200 people.
No, it wasn't even that big back then. That's after all the
Oh,
growth that has
that's
occurred.
after the
It was
growth.
about 1,000. It was about 1,000 when I was
Wow.
there. So, yeah.
Well, you know, and you already said that your dad was a farmer, but I think you grew up on a cattle ranch. That I guess your grandfather was a part of that too, right?
I think my grandfather is really where I get a lot of this. He was a go-getter. So my family came to Oklahoma in the land run, and my grandfather ended up homesteading our ranch here in Beggs. And he started really with nothing. I mean, he and my grandmother were married in the middle of the Great Depression, and so they started out with $8 total. They lived in an abandoned caboose, train caboose, and he would tell stories about how grandma would put up wallpaper and get it all looking nice, and they just couldn't get the train to seal. And so whenever it would rain, all the wallpaper would
Would
come
come
down. It
down.
just was heartbreaking. But he built a beautiful ranch, and my father has continued that. My dad was also a state legislator for a while, and great, great guy. And I would have gone to the ranch, except that we were at kind of a tough spot, and my dad said I couldn't get paid. And so that's how I ended up in the banking
The
business.
banking business. Well, yeah, and I thought that was such a funny story because he said, you could come to work here, but I can't pay you.
Hi,
That's not a good deal. That's not a good deal, Dad.
No, I was like, I didn't go to college all those years for nothing.
For nothing. That's
So,
right. So tell me, what
yeah.
was life like on the farm? I mean, I'm sure, Sean, you learned so many life lessons working on the farm. The value of hard work, probably one of them, right?
That is literally, it's almost like you just had a tape recorder in my office when I was just talking to my dad, because I was talking about honestly how our kids have not, they've not really had that benefit. You know, I mean, we're urban, we live in a nice neighborhood. They have chores, but it's not quite the same as daylight till dark. You know, baling hay, fixing fence, planting wheat, working cattle. I mean, that was just our life. That was just, and at the time, honestly, I was really irritated by it all. All my friends were down at the park playing basketball or swimming or, you know, doing all this fun stuff. And I was never getting home before. If it was daylight, that meant there was still work to be done. And it didn't get dark till 9 o'clock at night. And so I wasn't even getting home till 9 or 9:15. And, but you know this, Lisa, but looking back on it, and that's just what my dad and I were just talking about. You know, my son, I really need to figure out how to replicate this in his life, because it truly has been, you know, a great, great blessing. Aside from my spiritual walk, it's probably been the greatest blessing, because, you know, the value of hard work, seeing something accomplished. We showed cattle all my time growing up, and so you got to see the benefits of hard work in a tangible way, and it taught me so many things that I've been able to use throughout my life.
Yeah, my grandfather was a farmer too, and my dad tells the story. And there were four boys and one girl, and my dad tells the story. He said, you know, as young as I could remember, I was out there, you know, planting tobacco or doing whatever, you know, on the
Oh, yeah.
farm. And my dad just passed away a couple years ago, and you know, Sean, till almost the time that he passed, he was still working, and just, I don't know. I mean, just that value of hard work. And also, I think seeing how your contribution plays a part into the picture, and everybody had a contribution there, right? So I just think that there's so many great lessons. Well, good. I'm glad you already told me a little bit about your grandpa, because I was going to ask you to talk a little bit about your grandpa. But this is funny. I mean, you fully thought that you would go into the family business And so you went on to Oklahoma State University and got a degree in agriculture and economics because you're thinking, oh, this is what I'm going to need, right, to be in
that's
the family
right. That's right.
business. But I laughed at this. So you were the president of OSU's Interfraternity Council. And at one point, you found yourself with the college president. And this was what, Dr. Halligan? And you said, Dr. Yes. Halligan changed your life. Tell our listeners the story of you sitting there with Dr. Halligan and a few of the alumni. And what did they ask you, Sean?
Yeah, you have done some real research, Lisa. So I'm about to graduate from Oklahoma State University. It's the spring semester. I'm actually going to be a fall graduate. And so that is literally on the Sunday. It was probably, I'm going to say, in April. My dad had kind of told me, hey, you know, you're welcome to come to work back here, but you're not going to get paid. And so I was like, well, that's not going to work. So I drove over to Stillwater thinking, well, what am I going to do? I mean, I had no business experience, zero, no contacts. We didn't have any money. We had no influence. I thought, I didn't even begin to, know where to start. And so 2 days later, it's a Tuesday, I was invited by President Jim Halligan at OSU to attend this Board of Regents dinner. And so we were, and this is just something he did. He would always bring student leaders. It's very cool. He'd let us mingle with the big people, you know. And so we were in the second floor of the student union in the ballroom, and we were sitting around a round table. It was me, Dr. Halligan, and five members of the Board of Regents, and he asked me the question, what are you going to do when you graduate? And so instead of just being honest and telling him I really didn't know and kind of what had happened that weekend on the farm, I was too embarrassed. In my mind, I thought, well, you know, I'm a big man on campus, student leader, I'm about to graduate. I cannot tell these people that I don't know what I'm going to do. So I started scrambling. And in my mind, I was like, okay, I need to say something. And I glanced to my left, and this guy had a nameplate which said Bruce Benbrook, Chairman, Stock Exchange Bank, Woodward, Oklahoma. And I thought, that sounds good. You know, he had on a nice suit. He was on the board, and banking always, I remember my grandpa, and I mean, all this happened like in a spur of the moment, but I remember my grandpa saying, you know, when you move to a new town, you've got to get to know the local banker because they're more likely to loan you money if they know you than if they don't, which is true, which is illogical, but it is the truth. And so I thought, well, that's kind of a, prestigious kind of a title. And so I said, you know, I've been thinking about going into banking. And everybody around the table was like, what? We didn't know you were going into banking. And I said, oh, yeah. I said, it's a very recent career decision, which it was. It was about 10 seconds old.
Right.
And so they start asking me all these questions about banking. And I just bluff all the way through. What position? What kind of bank? All of these things. And I just kind of get through the dinner. And as we were walking out, Dr. Halligan really changed my life when he said, you know, Sean, I didn't realize that you wanted to go into banking. I've got a good friend that owns a group of banks in Oklahoma City. Maybe I can help you get a summer internship. And so, of course, I'm desperate. You know, I mean, I have no
prospect.
Nothing, no leads, no whatsoever. So I was thrilled to death. So I ran over, grabbed my resume, deleted out the old objective of farm and ranch management and put in there financial services professional, ran it over to his office, handed it off, and that's how I got into the banking business.
Mm-hmm. And I think a couple of days later, you got a call. And so that's really what catapulted
it. And the fact, and he, you know, I think about this, Lisa, a lot. And I know this is a leadership podcast. And so one of the things that really, really shifted in my life in that moment was I began to realize the value of being aware of opportunities to help people and always trying to do that, because Dr. Halligan had a lot more important things going on than helping a farm boy from Beggs, Oklahoma. I guarantee you that. But he did. He was interested. He did what he could do. He followed through. He didn't just say it. He actually followed through. And it literally changed my whole life. I mean, the whole trajectory of my life changed in that moment. It was just, I'll never forget it.
It's a great leadership lesson for all of us, Sean, to be looking for those opportunities, right? And
Yes.
yeah, and I know you're doing that today for others. So, but you went on into banking, and this is crazy to me, Sean. I think it was at maybe Grand Bank. I'm not 100% sure on that, but you came like a banking president, like really early, young. I mean, just a few years out of school, and you became the bank president. That is crazy.
18 months out of school.
18 months
It
out of
is great. It
school.
is
That's the
crazy. I would
quickest
have.
ascent to the C-suite, I think, that I've ever heard.
I think it's the youngest. I think I'm the youngest president of a bank. I think that's not. Now, maybe some, that were family members, maybe they inherited it or something. But to my knowledge, I know at the time I was the youngest one ever at 24. And it just was a family took a chance on me. They had seen my leadership skills at through college again. It was somebody that had some knowledge of me in school and saw something in me that frankly I didn't see, and have been in that, basically been in the same role ever since.
Ever since. Well, let me ask you this. What do you believe, Sean, were some of those traits that you've exhibited that they saw? That, what are the traits of a successful banker or bank exec?
I think what they saw at the time was I have always been a consensus builder. I've always been given that gift of having vision, but being able to bring my team alongside that vision. When I was recruited into my fraternity at OSU, we only had there were nine of us. I was trying to think if it's eight or nine. I think there were nine of us at the time. The fraternity had cleaned house. They had kicked everybody out. We were the first class back in. We were in this house all by ourselves, this big old fraternity house. And in about 2.5 years, we were named the top fraternity on campus. And that's what this individual had seen was my leadership during that time. I'd been rush chairman and president of the house, and it was a pretty remarkable turnaround. And of course, as you know, a lot of people had a role in that. I mean, it's leadership is not just you, it's the entire
Absolutely
team. But I think they saw that ability. And so, now all these years later, what I see as far as kind of the keys to a great executive. So we have seven market presidents here at Regent. And what I have noticed is those individuals who are really good listeners, who give very clear direction, who care about their people on a very personal level, who give a very high degree of autonomy, allow their team to do their job, but also hold them accountable for those results. Those seem to be the ones that are the best. And it's hard. It's almost like there's an it factor there, between someone that's firm enough to hold people accountable. You're not just walked over by everybody. You have high expectations, live our core values, and very high standards in what you do. But at the same time, you're very, very caring, and the people understand that how much you love them on a personal level, not just cogs in a wheel to get you from point A to point B. And it's the people that seem to be able to pull all of that together are in any industry. It really doesn't matter. I happen to be in banking, so that's where I see it. But in any industry, they seem to be very, very successful.
Yeah, that's so good. Well, let's talk about Regent. Because here you are, 34 years old, 10 years later, and you got a group of people together, I think 80 maybe investors together.
That's right.
And yes, bought this bank. I think you raised like nearly $16 million. You were a $70 million bank when you bought it. And I think today you're upward to like $1.7 billion, maybe $1.9 billion in assets now with seven locations. But I want you to tell our listeners about this. So I think that was in the spring of 2008. And then if anybody remembers what happened in the fall of 2008, the economy collapsed.
I remember.
I know
very
you
did. Clearly.
Yeah. And I think you had somebody tell you, you bought this bank at the, you said it was a terrible time in history. And the guy goes, no, it's the worst time in history that you bought the bank. So what That's happened, right. Sean? I know you were stressed and everything, but you know, there was also, you know, God had a miracle in there for you. So tell our listeners this story.
It was the miracle of my life. So you're exactly right on all your data. So we bought the bank on April Fool's Day of 2008, had about 5 or 6 months of just super fun. I felt like I was like Leonardo DiCaprio in Titanic. I was the king of the world, you know, when he's on the front of the ship. Yes. That was me for about 6 months. And then I really was the Titanic and everything began to sink. So in the fall is when the mortgage crisis hit. And we didn't do mortgages. We were just a small community bank in Nowata, Oklahoma, which wasn't much bigger than Beggs. But the problem was, for those of you that remember, everything shut down. I mean, it wasn't just the mortgage crisis. It was the entire economy came to a screeching halt. I had never seen it before. Nobody I had ever worked with had really seen that before. Now, the 1980s in Oklahoma were very, very difficult because of the oil bust. But I wasn't working at that time. I was watching cartoons during that time. Right. So I'd never seen anything like it. So without getting into too much detail, I've always viewed challenging times as tremendous opportunities. So, you know, whenever everybody else stops, that's when I tend to go. And that's what I thought we would do at this time. So you really had two things going on. You had the bank losing money because our customers were not able to make their loan payments and we were having to charge off the loans, sell what collateral we could. We had enormous losses month after month after month. And then you also had me growing the business to beat the band, okay? Which is not a good combination in banking because one of the key ratios in banking is what is the capital ratio, which is basically capital divided by assets. So if capital's going down and assets are going up, that number is getting smaller, much smaller yes. by the day. Mm-hmm. So by the time we get to February of 2009, it did not look like we were going to survive. So our capital ratios were below what our regulators require. They had already shut down hundreds of banks. I had called our largest investors. So we had no money. We had put everything we had into the bank, which I know is really, really bad advice, but I was so positive that it was going to be great. Right. Yes, I just believed in it so much. And so I hadn't taken a paycheck for 6 months. My wife's job had moved to Houston. I mean, we had no income. My daughter was 2 years old. I mean, it was rough. And so I want you to just, and for your listeners to just imagine this for just a moment. So I am in church. It's February 15th of 2009. My world is literally has collapsed, okay? The bank is about to go under. I figure we have 40 days left to get to the end of the quarter when we file a call report. The regulators will see how bad our numbers are. They will shut us down. That's what I think is going to, I'm positive that's what's going to happen. I've already been turned down by my investors. They're not going to put any more capital in. I have no more capital. I have $1,200 in the bank and a $1,700 mortgage payment due on Thursday. I have not told my wife what dire circumstances that we are in. Okay? I am teaching Sunday school, faking it every step of the way, teaching Sunday school classes on Jesus says, don't worry, while I'm about to have a nervous breakdown.
Right.
Okay? My wife teaches the kids' Sunday school class. We get out of church late. We're on the front row, and the band is singing the song Healer, that Carrie Job song, I Believe You're My Healer, I Believe You're More Than Enough for Me. And as they are singing this, I am thinking, this is the biggest bunch of baloney that I have ever heard in my life. Nothing, no healing is occurring in my life. Everything's getting worse by the day. And as I am thinking this, the Lord says to me, do you believe I am your healer? And it is so clear. Everybody is singing, but suddenly they became totally quiet. And it was like all I could hear was this, and it makes me cry every time. I still can't get through it. So I hear this and I lose it in church. Okay, I break down crying, all the stress, all and the power of just that moment. I just cannot stop crying. So I say, God, here's the deal. If you're gonna save all this, my life, investors, jobs, all that, it's going to have to be you because I don't know what else to do. I've been working 20 hours a day, every day. Nothing's working. Everything's getting worse. I can't eat. I can't sleep. And so I basically just say, I give up. I give up. You're going to have to save it. Well, 2 days later, I am up at our bank that we initially bought in Nowata, and we have 80 letters that are going to go to our 80 shareholders. And they basically say what I've told you. If we don't raise $3 million by the end of the first quarter, which is 40 days away, we're gonna get shut down and we're all gonna lose everything. And I'm so sorry about this. I had no idea we were going into the mortgage crisis, blah, 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 blah. So one of my employees, Sandy, is walking out of the door, out the door, or toward the door, I should say, with these letters. I get a phone call to my left, and Arlene says, Sean, you have a phone call from the U.S. Treasury Department. That's who shuts down banks. So I think, well, we're done. They've seen, they've heard, they know how bad a shape we're in. So I yell out to Sandy and say, hey, bring those letters back. It's too late. She turns around and she's crying. I walk around to my office and pick up the phone, and the lady on the other end says, her name was Lisa as well, by the way. She
Good name.
says, Mr. Copeland, this is Lisa Taylor with the U.S. Treasury Department. How are you today? And I said, well, Lisa, it kind of depends on how this phone call goes. And she laughed. She's like, yeah, a lot of people tell us that, you know. And I'm like, this is my life, you know, here. And she said, well, the reason that I'm calling today is because Regent Bank has been chosen for the capital purchase program, and we would like to invest up to $3 million in your bank. And as you know, it was the miracle of my life. The money came in that day. It had a 1% interest rate, 9 years to pay it back. No board seat, no dilution. We paid it back the next year. It was, and the bank was saved. I mean, we continued. And so everything that has happened now really is a result of that moment. It changed my life. So it was very important, obviously, that it saved the bank and the jobs. But honestly, probably more important is leading up to that. I lived a life of extreme fear. You know, we had some ups and downs financially growing up. There were some challenging things about, you know, my life on the farm. And I just had in my mind that everything was going to go bad. I just knew it was. And so that moment was the equivalent of a miraculous healing. It was as if from that moment, I knew how much God loved me. I knew how much he cared about me. I knew that I could trust in him, and I've not experienced that since. It was like in the blink of an eye, I was healed. And so we've gone through difficult times since. You know, it's not like everything is an inclining slope, but I now know that there is a purpose behind everything that happens, and I truly can trust in God, just like it says in Romans, that He works everything out for the good. He absolutely has for us.
That is, I love that story so much, Sean, really. And I mean, just the way that all of that ties in, I mean, that's just how good God is, that you're sitting there hearing this song about healing, and He healed that fear in you and replaced it with faith. I mean, because you know, when you see something like that happen in your life, you're like, okay, God, you took care of that then. You're with me now. And whatever it is,
Yes.
it totally changes the way you view things going forward. You
Totally,
know,
totally.
I was just thinking, lessons learned, miracles still happen. Miracles still
Oh,
happen.
yeah. Oh, yeah.
You don't have as much control over things as you think, right? I
Oh,
mean,
yeah.
none of
Oh,
us had
yeah.
control in 2020 and what happened there.
Right.
You know, taking one day at a time, don't live in fear. Your original vision for what you visioned for Regent Bank is about a third of what has really happened, Sean. And so God is able to do more than you could ask or imagine. There's so much more I want to talk about, but we do need to take a quick break, and we'll be right back with Sean Copeland on the Something Extra podcast.
In business, the tendency is to seek out partners who are bigger, faster, stronger. When it comes to IT, you should be looking for smarter, faster, better. That's just what you'll find with the talented technologists at Technology Partners. Our experts develop custom solutions to tackle your most complex challenges, all to simplify your processes in the smartest, most efficient way possible. The time to be swift and nimble starts now. Go to technologypartners.net/solutions and see what's possible.
So welcome back, everyone, to the Something Extra podcast with my friend Sean Copeland. Sean, we've just been having so much fun just talking about all kinds of different things, but I'd love for you to tell our listeners the purpose statement for Regent Bank.
So our purpose is to show God's love to our employees, clients, and communities.
Yeah. How important is love?
You know, it's everything. So Lisa and I know we only have so much time, but here's where this came from. We had years ago, 10 years ago, set this goal to be a $1 billion institution. Okay, so we thought that it would take, I mean, honestly, at the time, $1 billion, we might as well have said we were going to be a $1 trillion institution. I mean, we couldn't even fathom really what $1 billion was. And so we achieve it, and we achieve it about 7 years before we thought that we possibly could. And so I'm here in my office, and I pull up my, you know, on my computer, our balance sheet for the day, and it says $1 billion on it. And honestly, I was so, it was a neat deal. But all of a sudden, I realized, you know, nothing has really changed in my life. I mean, nothing is different because of this. And that's when I thought, you know, work. So what am I going to do now? Motivate everybody around getting
Two
to 2
billion.
billion or 5 or 10 or whatever. And it's like, it's just a number. And so I began to really pray about, and I asked my executive team, let's really pray about what is our true purpose. Okay, what is our real reason for existing? And at the end of the day, we really want to be a light. We know how difficult the world is. It's getting more difficult. And so if there was some place where people could interact, you know, where they come in or call us on the phone, even virtually or via email, where they would feel better when they were done, where they could see love, and we attribute love to God. And so that is where that purpose statement came from. And it was petrifying when I proposed it to our executive team. I thought, man, they are going to think I have absolutely lost it. And we had some great discussion around it and approved it unanimously. And it's changed everything about what we do.
Yeah, that's a high purpose. That is a high purpose, Sean. Because at the end of the day, really, truly, it all boils down to people. and how you impact them and how you make a difference in their life, right? So I just, yes. I love that so much. Well, I do want to talk about this. So you in May of 2023, I guess it was, you started a faith at work movement called 94X. And I have your book here, 94X, and I've shown you where, yes, I have not just skimmed this. I have actually read it. I've underlined it. I've dog-eared it. It's so good. The subtitle for this is Everything Changes When You Bring God Into Your Business. And I would just highly encourage. Now, Sean is a multi-time author. He has written lots of books. The Abundance Mindset, I think. I don't have the list of all of them here, but you've written several books. This is the one that I've read, though. So go get all of his books. But I can tell you this one is really good. You know, you wrote this book with your good friend. Is it Mick Chovanec? Is that right, Chovanec?
It's actually a Skuvanec.
Skuvanec.
It's a doozy. Skuvanec. It's a doozy. Skuvanec. When you take Copeland and Skuvanec and put them together, nobody's ever pronounced our names right.
So, yeah. So, you know, how did you, tell me again how you met Mick? You guys have a friendship that kind of started like more like mentor type ship or something like that. And then you guys become best friends.
Mick was going through a challenging time in his life, and he really was looking for a mentor. And so I've always done a lot of speaking, led organizations in town. And so he would see that, and he thought that he really wanted me to be his mentor. So he was calling the office, and we were growing. We didn't have very many people. I was wearing about 15 hats. I was pretty sure he was just calling to sell me something. And so I was not accepting a meeting with him. I didn't know who he was. And so finally, a mutual friend of ours reached out and said, hey, you know, this guy's been trying to set a meeting with you. If you'd sit down with him, that'd be great. We did sit down. I did realize what he was looking for, but truthfully, the relationship has been 50-50. What I have seen in our relationship is total purity of love for each other. Nobody wants anything from the other person. Nobody's trying to sell something. It was just magical. So that's what led to the abundance mentality. The abundance mentality is kind of this mindset of just going into relationships with an empty bag, pure, just to help that other person, period. And then whether that's your solution or not, you know, it doesn't matter. You're just trying to help, and it leads to tremendous abundance at the end of the day. Well, so we wrote that book together, and then he ended up being my co-author in 94X as well.
Yeah, I love it. So tell us where 94X came from, because I know that you figured it out on a flight from Tulsa to Dallas, and you figured you like formulas, right? Sean, so you're
like, I like formulas.
You like formulas.
I like formulas. Yes.
So tell us where it came from.
Here's what happened. So I had completed my Secretary of Commerce duties for the governor. I had come back to the bank. I felt the Lord calling me to the integration of faith in business, that what we had experienced here at Regent was so magical that I needed to be able to share that with others and let them experience the same thing. So I am on a flight going from Tulsa to Dallas. It's only like a 45-minute flight. It is not a long flight. I'm sitting next to a friend of mine. It's a Southwest flight, so we got to choose who we sit next to. So I'm sitting next to my buddy Corey, and I'm telling him this vision that I have about how, you know, Christian business leaders need to understand that they can bring God into their business, not illegal. And so he was like, oh my gosh, you know, that could be what our world needs. And you need to do something, Sean. And if you'll do something, I'll support you. And so we take off, and I just close my eyes, and I'm like, God, what does this look like? What do you want me to do? You know, how exactly? There's a lot of faith in business stuff. What are we supposed to do? And when I closed my eyes, I saw this black, almost like a chalkboard, with two white numbers, one on top of the other one. And the top one was 160, then there was a line, and then the bottom one was 1.7. And I knew exactly what they were. 160 was the number of hours that our employees worked in a given month. 1.7 was the number of hours they went to church. And the message was that as a business leader, I have my employees in my care 94 times more than they go in the walls of a church. And that's just those that go. That's only about 40% of my employees. And so the Lord basically said, listen, that's why I put you in these positions of authority. It wasn't to become wealthy or to make other people wealthy or win a bunch of, leadership awards
Awards.
and all that jazz. It was to be a shepherd. And so that is where 94X, that's how 94X was
I
born.
love it. I love it. Yeah, you say business is to be about more than making money and growing assets. It must be about genuine love, care, and investing in your employees. So many people have no purpose. There's no greater purpose than serving Jesus, which gives meaning to everything we do. I love that. So, we could talk about all kinds of things here, but I know that we're kind of running out of time. I do want to talk about chapter 11 because I think this is really good. I think there's some tactics in here, Sean, that may help our people, our listeners. So this is called leading ourselves. And I love this quote. I'm kind of a quote junkie. And so you start out with the John Mackey quote. He's the founder and CEO for Whole Foods. As I go, so goes my business. So this is all about leading yourself. And you've got a subtitle in here called The Magic of Mornings. And I was thinking, Sean, it's kind of like the Miracle Morning, kind of what you do. I don't know if you've ever read The Miracle Morning, but that's the 2020.
No.
It's a 1 hour 2020 of exercise, reading the Bible, or whatever spiritual, affinity you have, and then 20 minutes of learning something else. But tell me about your mornings. What's your morning routine?
So I get up at 5, stumble to the coffee maker, put in my Starbucks pod. Drink a cup of coffee, and then I immediately jump on the treadmill. So that's kind of my, I kind of need that to kind of wake up. And so I do 30 minutes of exercise, and then I move into a time of really reflection. And so I'll pray. I'll spend some time in gratitude. I spend quite a bit of time in forgiveness because one of the things, in business, we're gonna get done wrong. I mean, that's just the way we're in a fallen world. And so people are gonna do things that disappoint us. And I've had to learn to totally let all that stuff go. I spend time in the Word. I also listen to, it's unbelievable how much of the Bible you can listen to on the treadmill. So I use YouVersion, and it's May the 13th. I've already been through the whole Bible just from listening to it on the treadmill. And if I'm driving or something, and I'm not on the phone, it's really amazing. And so anyway, so I spend time in prayer, and then I organize my day. And so all of that all together takes about an hour and 15 minutes. And then that's really where I begin the day. Get breakfast for the kids, get them up, get them to school, get into the office usually around 7:30. So mornings have been so important for me just because of mindset, trying to get my mind right, making sure I know what I want to accomplish, visualizing the day. It's just so important.
Yeah. And I think I even read, or maybe I made it up. You can tell me if I made it up. I think I read where you said, I want to, what are my top 3 to 5 priorities for the day? I mean, you don't have 20 of them, Sean. I think that's a really good leadership lesson as well, because if you have 20, the chances of you really, I mean, what are your highest value priorities for the day? Which I really love that. And then you have a 2 hour living rule, and then I'd love for you to talk about the 6:30 rule, which I think is really good.
Yeah, these are both very simple, but have been really game changers for me. So, the 2-hour living, I read a book once by some Harvard professor that said that if you'll take a break every 2 hours for 10 or 15 minutes, it really expands your stamina and you're not so tired at night when you go home. And so, I started doing that. But during that, every 2 hours, I stop and have 15 minutes of prayer. And so it's hard, it's pretty easy to get derailed in a day. But if you're doing it in 2 hours, okay, and you're going, okay, Lord, thank you for the last 2 hours. Thank you for that meeting. Thank you for let me pray for that person. Now for the next 2 hours, let me pray for this and this and this. You stay pretty close to him. So I literally, at 10, and then of course at lunch. And then at 2, and then at 4, I stop and have, it's on my calendar. I have, I call it 2-hour living, and I have 15-minute breaks where I just grab a snack, I'll walk around, and I just pray. And it's been wonderful. The 6:30 rule came from almost losing my marriage, unfortunately. I was overworking. I was always had something going on in the evening. It was all out of fear. I wanted to be so important and, Mr. Everything in my hometown, thinking that, well, I won't get fired if I'm everything to everybody, And I was just never home. And my wife, who is the most amazing human on the planet, would every 90 days go, hold on now, this isn't really what I signed up for. I'm not the housekeeper and the maid and the nanny, And so, and I would do better, I'd apologize, I'd feel terrible, I'd do better for a couple of weeks. And finally one day, I came home and she was packed up and getting ready to leave, and it scared me so much. I thought, what am I doing? Why? What am I? It kind of scared me straight, so to speak. And so now, for the rest of my life, at 6:30, I turn off my phone, plug it in, put it away, focus on the family. Do not do work in the evenings. Try to be present with my kids and my wife. Probably one of the best things I've ever done.
Sean, I love that you put boundaries there, because I will tell you something, as an entrepreneur, as an owner, as the present CEO, there's always more to do. Always
Oh,
more
yeah.
to do. You never
Always.
ever feel caught up. And I will find myself, and I mean, I can struggle with this too. I mean, I had one of my daughters yesterday goes, do you realize that even like when we're sitting watching a movie, that you're like on your laptop or you're on your phone or doing something? And I'm like, you're right. Thank you. Thank you for holding me accountable, right? And
It's easy to do. It's very easy to do,
it's so
particularly when your
easy to do.
mind works fast, which I know yours does. You like to stay busy, but I was getting the same thing. I was texting all the time, looking at my phone. They're talking to me. I'm not even listening to what they're saying, and I'm like, that's got to go. So,
It's got to go. It's got to go. It'll be there tomorrow.
always
But
there. It's always
your
there.
family, you want your family to be there too, right, Sean? So
Yes,
I have
yes.
one more thing to talk to you about, because it's so cool, and then we'll talk about something extra. So I think someone had sent me a video after Matt had introduced us and we had talked. Somebody else, and I still can't remember who for the life of me, sent me this video, and they said, Lisa, you're gonna love this. You are gonna love this. And it was an amazing video. And then I like put two and two together. I'm like, that coach is Sean. But tell our listeners what happened in the spring of 2022.
So you're hitting on all the best points of my life, Lisa. So in the spring of 2022, I had a whole bunch of dads from the Tulsa. I've always coached baseball. Okay, ever since my son was 5 years old, I've been the coach. I love the game. I love the boys. It is my happy place. So a bunch of my buddies were like, "Hey, you've got to coach a Little League World Series team for Tulsa. You know, we need to go to the Little League World Series." Blah blah blah. Well, Oklahoma was 0-42 in the Little League World Series. Okay, we had never won. It had not been a great experience in the past, and I had a lot going on. And so I very rarely say no, which is a huge flaw of mine. But in this instance, I was like, "Guys, I just can't. I mean, I'm already coaching one team. I got all this stuff going on with the kids and at work and all this stuff." So I said no until my son in Sunday school class, which was taught by my wife, wrote down, she asked them, "What's your biggest dream? What's the one thing you would love to accomplish?" And he writes down in pink crayon on this little index card, "My dream is to play in the Little League World Series." So I was like, "Oh my goodness," she brought it to me in church. And so I immediately called my buddies and I'm like, "Okay, I'm in. I will do it." So
Amen.
long story short, we put a team together. We literally had 2 months to get ready. We go down to Waco, Texas, playing the regionals in the so all of the state champions from seven surrounding states all played in this regional to see who would go to Williamsport. So, we are heavy, heavy, heavy underdogs. Our boys do remarkable. I mean, remarkable. We make it all the way to the finals. Everybody was getting so excited. I mean, the governor is sending us videos. All these major league players are sending us videos. All the college coaches from our state are sending us. It was really a big deal. We're on the news every night. It was so fun. So we get all the way to the finals, and we're playing against a team from the Houston area who, I'm telling you, these young men were 6'5". They had mustaches. They're 12 years old. They have biceps bigger than my head. I mean, it was unbelievable. So, and they really are 12 years old. Believe me, they check this out. You cannot cheat in Little League World Series any longer. I can assure you of that. So they're really good. They just beat the other favorite team 19-1 the night before. We're playing them in the finals, and everybody thinks it's going to be a massive blowout, but it's really not. They score three at the top of the first inning. We score two in the bottom of the first inning, and my shortstop, Isaiah Jarvis, comes up to bat. Okay. We have runners on first and second. Isaiah is an unbelievable baseball player, but kind of a mid-level hitter. And the young man who's pitching is throwing 84 miles an hour from 46 feet away, which is the equivalent of 127 in the pros. Okay. So, I mean, that ball is getting there really fast. So he's down 0-2. He's got no balls, two strikes, one more strike, and he's out. And Caden, the pitcher, throws a curveball, but it doesn't break. Isaiah thinks it's going to break. It's kind of coming at his head. He doesn't move, thinking it's going to break. It keeps on coming, hits him in the side. It looks like it hits him in the face. Kind of hits him in the side of the face. He falls down. He's motionless. I think he's dead. We all run up there. He's laying down on the ground. I kind of pull his head up out of the dirt. Pretty soon, he actually kind of comes to. And so all the medical staff come out and check him out. They do a concussion test. They think he's okay. And so he kind of walks down to first base. Well, everybody gives him a standing ovation. The announcers are like, "Man, that kid is tough. I can't believe he's getting up and going to keep playing." He gets there and realizes that the pitcher is crying out on the mound. And it's because they are really good friends. They have become great friends. We were all in the same hotel, and those two had become best buddies. And so Caden is just crying, crying. Isaiah pitches his helmet to the side, walks out to the middle of the field, goes to the pitcher's mound, gives Caden a big old hug, tells him, you can hear him on the microphone telling him, "You're a great pitcher. You are, I know you didn't do this on purpose. Shake it off. You're fine. You're awesome. You can do this," And you hear him say, "I love you and Jesus loves you," in the recording. And so he goes back to the base. The young man just can't ever quite get it together. We end up finishing the game. They end up winning. But here's and many people have seen that because now 200 million people have seen that video. Here's what's wild. The rest of the story is this. We finish the game. We go to Outback for lunch. That's where they want to have their final lunch. We had rented this awesome Hummer limo for them to ride, so they were fine. It took them about 7 minutes, and they got over the loss, and so everything's good. On the way over, my phone starts ringing off the hook, and it is every major channel, sports and news in the world, calling to do a video with Isaiah. This video has gone viral like they've never
Viral.
seen, and everybody wants to talk to this young man. And so we did 28 interviews from the Outback booth with me holding my phone, doing a Zoom. And I mean, it was wild. And so it has literally changed my life. That's what I'm now known for. It's not CEO, Secretary of Commerce, business guy. It's none of
Right.
that. It's Little League coach. That's
Little
my
League
claim to
coach.
fame. Isaiah's world famous, and I'm telling you, and in every interview, Lisa, that he does, they will say, "Why did you do that, Isaiah? Man, that makes no sense. Why would you walk out there in the middle of the game?" And he said, "I was standing on first base, and my heart just told me that he needed to experience the love of Jesus in that moment." That's what he says in every interview. Isaiah Jarvis has touched more people than I will touch in my entire life. There's no question about it because of that moment. So,
Oh,
pretty cool.
Sean, I
Pretty
love you
cool.
so much. And I said clearly, Sean, the parents are teaching these young men more than baseball. And that's more than
Well,
baseball.
and if I could, and I know we're short on time, but just a quick add-on to that. A couple of days earlier, I would always lead our kids in a devotional before we played, and we would obviously say a prayer. And we were playing Mississippi 2 days earlier, and two of my guys came in, knocked on my door, and said, "Hey, coach, could we invite the kids from Mississippi, or our friends from Mississippi, to come to our devotional before the game tomorrow?" And I thought, man, that is so cool. So I reached out to their coach. He agreed. And so before we did our warm-ups, and then right before the game started, we all gathered at home plate. We did a quick devotional. I told them, how much God loved them. He knew they were going to be in this moment, from the day that they were born. There was such a purpose on their life, and how blessed they were to play this great game on TV and all that kind of stuff. And ESPN picked that up and showed it all over the country. And this type of thing, to this day, most of the regions all over the country, the teams get together and pray together from what happened in that moment. So there was such a, the day that we got to Waco, my assistant coach said, "Sean, I really believe this is bigger than baseball." He said, "I can't explain it, but there's just something happening here that I think is bigger than baseball." And it was. Nobody really remembers who won any of the games, but everybody
But they
remembers the
remember
hug
that.
that occurred on the mound.
It's
Yeah.
so cool.
Amazing.
I love it so much. So much, so much, so much. So we will make sure that we put that video clip in our show notes, Sean,
Great. Yeah, that'd be great.
when the episode goes live. Well, Sean, this is called Something Extra. I have to ask you, what do you believe is the something extra that every leader needs?
I have to answer with two answers,
That's
okay?
fine.
Because I struggle with this. I've never been asked this question before. And so let me give a two-part answer. I think the first thing that you have is faith. Because you cannot. I've got a friend of mine that said every morning he would pull up to his company, and the bigger it got, the more nervous he got, and he would literally throw up in the bushes before he went into work. He was so scared of what was ahead of him in that day. And if we believe that it's all about us and all the pressure is on us, you know, and you start looking at all these mouths that we have to feed and all that kind of thing, it will drive you crazy. So you have to know how much God loves you. You can trust in Him. You can ask Him when you need help. He is there for you. And you know, you just have to kind of listen and obey. And secondarily, mm-hmm. beyond a faith, I think, is the ability to listen. I think that in our world today, everybody is talking. Everybody wants to be heard. Everybody, you know, we all want followers and blah, 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 all that kind of stuff. When you listen and truly care about people, they will do anything for you. They will do anything mm-hmm. for you, and it changes their lives. So I would say you got to have faith. And you've got to listen both to your people, to your clients, but also to the voice of Jesus Christ, because He will guide and direct you. All the things that have happened in our bank have been the result of just trying to listen and obey, you know, to what we felt led to do.
Mm-hmm. Oh my goodness, Sean, this has been so much fun. Thank you so much for making the time. It's been amazing. I cannot wait for our listeners to learn from you. And I know that I have, just sitting here with you. And I can't thank you enough for the time. I appreciate you, my friend.
You're the best interviewer ever, Lisa. You're the best. So thank you for the opportunity. I'm very humbled.
Thank you for listening to today's show. Something Extra with Lisa Nichols is a Technology Partners production. Copyright Technology Partners, Inc., 2019. For show notes or to reach Lisa, visit tpi.co/podcast. Don't forget to leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you listen.